Hey, it's Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy in London, except we're in New York City, aren't we?
Yes, we're in New York and we're actually heading to London as you listen to this. So, of course, there were the Black Friday sales day, Thanksgiving, the day after Thanksgiving. And do you want to explain to the Brits? I'm sure they all know because Black Friday arrived in the UK about 5, 7 years ago, just soon after Halloween arrived.
The British people now have this big annual sale day that I guess started in the US. The day after Thanksgiving became a big shopping day. I always thought that it was because it's the day that the retailers go in the black for the year and they go into profit for the year. Then I read something today, actually, that it well, there's another story about how it got the name Black Friday, but the novelty of it in the last few years has been that they have these big fights and brawls that break out at these stores. And I saw today a breakdown of which states in America are most likely to have these big brawls, where people get beat up, shoved. I think in the last couple of years, someone actually got trampled to death. You can get a huge flat screen TV for 70 or 80% off the normal price is, and so people go into these stores brawling. But I think part of it is the brawl has become part of the shopping experience. It's kind of like that movie Fight Club. People go into basements and beat each other up, because there's something cathartic about getting beat up or beating somebody up. And there's no gunplay. No one brings guns. It's just fisticuffs. And I like that film, Fight Club. I think a lot of people go and every year, and they like to get into a good punch up. And it gets the heart rate going. You get a good deal on a toaster or a TV set. So it's quite entertaining.
Yeah, well, I think they're kind of cracking down on this in the UK because they're apparently not as amused as Americans are. Of course, it fills the entire schedule for the day. It for the news organizations, the daily news is, or the 24-hour cable channels just run 24 hours of brawls at all these places. Apparently, the sales are pretty slow this year. Of course, jibing with the sense that there's some sort of global depression going on, which if you look at some numbers, the government and the central banks have you believing that it's all okay, because stock markets and house prices, which they can control more or less, go up. But the markets that are way too huge for them to control, like oil, shipping, copper, all these things have plunged to basically the way almost mirroring 2007, 8, and 9. So in the rest of the world, in the financial metrics system, the indicators, it's a Great Depression going on right now again. But anyway, this apparently it's also represented in the sales that people aren't even actually going out to fist fight anymore for a 50, 60% discount because they can't even afford that. I did buy one shirt because we happened to go by a shop in Manhattan that had nobody in it. So I walked in because I thought, oh, here's an empty shop. I'll go in. And there was a nice blouse it was $340 on sale for 50. No tax, so I thought, hey, why not? That's about 30 pounds. So what do you think about this Great Depression?
Well, the numbers on the Black Friday sales are there's a lot of variables, because in the last few years, a lot of the commerce has gone online, so people are not physically showing up at the stores. And then you always hear conflicting numbers during the whole thing, that sales are up, sales are down, and it's not a week or 2 weeks later until they have some some kind of final tallying up, and then they factor in, Monday is Cyber Monday, which is a kind of a online shopping day on Monday. Of course, this is all prelude to Christmas. And as retailers get more desperate every year, the whole sales, started before Black Friday, then it's Black Friday, then it's Christmas. So they're really trying to squeeze in some sales, trying to get some sales done. And as far as the depression goes, you have the global depression. It's you have this marking down of estimates for global growth coming from IMF and other organizations pretty consistently. I think actually they just downgraded global growth again within the last week or so. And the introduction post 2008 of quantitative easing has slowed the global economy down. It's the opposite of what they was trying to do. I saw somebody refer to quantitative easing as a cement blanket that has prevented GDP from growing. Certainly, it hasn't become anywhere near growth, positive to the point where tax revenues can begin to pay down debt. So debt is imploding, and spectacularly by reports, some reports in China, where the government has cracked down on dodgy brokerages, and one Chinese executive has gone missing from a large brokerage in China that is been involved in lots of illicit activity. Now there's lots and lots of brokerages coming under scrutiny. The government itself has gone into the market and bought up to something like 6% of all the listed stocks in China are now owned by the government. So this is a government desperately trying to stop the stock market from decreasing as the global debt bubble. I would say the global debt bubble is continuing to implode, but the global depression, it's masked in many ways because you still have this bifurcated market where the uber rich can buy a Modigliani for $170 million, shattering all previous records. But at the same time, you have average wages and real incomes really continuing to contract.
Well, I think Switzerland, the central bank there, owns a lot of shares equity as well. So the Chinese seem to be following on what the West has already set in motion. But of course, also again favoring a certain class of speculator over almost everybody else in the economy, because the government is basically acting as just like corporations are acting, which is they've run out of ideas. This is the first year that there are actually more share buybacks than there are revenues. So they're spending more on share buybacks than they're actually earning. This is so every single penny that comes in the door, they goes to share buybacks in the terms of loans. Basically, they're borrowing from bond holders to buy, to pay off their equity investors. I don't know what bondholders think they're going to get, but a carcass, and then they sell those bits off, when all these companies collapse eventually, because if they're not investing, because you need CapEx, you need to invest in the future and in future production, the future of the company, the
Well,
future
this
of the
is
business.
another offshoot of the collapse of labor and labor movements and unions, because you wouldn't see this in Germany because they have such a strong labor movement in Germany, and workers are so fairly represented on the board of directors of these various companies that you don't see German companies buying back their own stock. That would be considered a ludicrous waste of money. But in the United States, where labor and labor unions have been, for the most part, completely destroyed. There's some vestiges left in some public sectors, but I don't know. There's no private labor unions anymore. I think the car unions have been completely decimated, and certainly in industrial and manufacturing, it's all been moved overseas. So corporations who would maybe be held accountable by workers for wasting money on buying back their own stock to line the pockets of executives, they just don't exist anymore. The p politicians are not offering any kind of counterbalancing economic plan here because many of them are also shareholders of these companies and they benefit widely from this activity.
Well, but also, this is a story we covered during the last bit of the first wave of the Great Depression of 2007, 2008, and that is that, in Germany, it's not just the workers, it's the actual owners of these companies. They actually choose actively not to list their companies. And the reason why they choose actively not to list their companies, no matter what the pressure from the markets, is that they want to make sure they want to keep their business. They want to hand it down to the next generation of their family as well. And they know that shareholders demand that the company be destroyed. So this is why this is an active policy by the company owners in Germany.
Yes, that's it's a very different culture that supports a very vibrant and wealthy middle class, where you don't see that really in the UK or the United States, where the middle class is being completely wiped out. So it's interesting, though. Of course, in Europe, of which Germany is the center of Europe and the biggest economy of Europe, of course, is undergoing huge existential changes and threats coming from terror attacks on one hand, plus failed states like Greece on the other hand. So this is another a different dimension that they're dealing with there in terms of the wave of jihadists that have gone west, and so this is kind of a variable.
Yeah, well, the only existential crisis about the jihadist is the fact that it could see Schengen end and therefore the European Union and the euro currency. But there is another situation that has emerged over the past week, which is a new story since we were last on air. And that was the Turkey downing the Russian jet, and this is a NATO member, Turkey, downing the Russian jet, and they're still disputing who crossed borders, or if not, whether or not they did, and whether or not the U.S. supplied any sort of information to the Turks about what Russia's flight plan was, because Russia did file a flight plan with the U.S. So it's heating up, but as soon as the Turks shot down this plane, it looks like they got the cold shoulder from all their other NATO members, and including kind of the US, which didn't really come to their aid. In fact, we were here in the United States and watching CNN, and I assumed, because most of the news is often knee-jerk anti-Russia, that all their guests, everybody was unanimously that this is Turkey's fault, and Turkey shouldn't have shot down this plane, and this is bad, and why did they do this? And all the US generals that they had as guests were saying that we would never shoot down a plane if for only a few seconds in our airspace. You can tell when it's hostile or not. The Swedish general who said, oh, we would only fire a warning shot, we wouldn't shoot down a jet.
Yeah, I'm sorry to imagine what Turkey is trying to accomplish here, but it does look like it will lead to Russia declaring a no-fly zone in Syria, so therefore Russia would control the airspace above Syria. So countries like Britain, where David Cameron is just now, they're preparing a vote as to whether the UK should send bombers into Syria. Well, it looks like they would have to get the green light first from Russia, as the same from the United States or the French or anyone else. I mean, it would be the Russia would control the airspace. So, and they're doing so because of the hostilities and the acts of war perpetrated by NATO member Turkey, and which is a war by any other name. I think so far Russia has shown a lot of restraint.
Well, of course, for the market news, of course, the defense shares or have been very up ever since the Paris bombings attacks, and of course they continue to rise on things like Turkey shooting down a Russian jet. And also, of course, it looks like, I kind of believe that story that they showed the flight path of these Turkish jets circling round and round and round and round, like they were waiting for the Russian jets to arrive
Yep.
to shoot them down. And then, as Lindsay Hilsum from Channel 4, who is there in Turkey, she said, it seemed suspicious to her that the actual Turkish news was also there to film this shooting down of the jet. And then the militants, the terrorists, whatever you want to call them, the rebels, moderate rebels on the ground in northern Syria where the plane came down, they were also on hand to film it and shoot at least one of the pilots dead. So, you've got a lot of, it's kind of wag the dog as well. Like everything is stage managed or in our
Yeah,
world.
very troubling, very troubling. Plus the revelation now that Turkey is the main supplier of weapons to ISIS. So this is not putting them in a real good frame there. And we were just in Istanbul a few months ago. And there were a lot of military jets flying overhead.
It was their like their Independence Day.
Okay. And so, the attitude of the new government, which finally got a majority, it was a bit of a poison chalice from the locals who felt that, yes, this guy is a reactionary nincompoop, but it's what we need to get business done. Business, he's pro business, and we got to get inflation down and interest rates down. And sure, he might end up blowing the country's place in the entire region and committing all kinds of egregious acts against and supply ISIS, but we still want to sell more tchotchkes down at the Turkish taffy shop. So there seemed to be a real, as I said, it's a real devil's choice there. Even that show we just saw with Anthony Bourdain, he interviewed a local businessman who was convinced that Turkey was facing east, and that their friends were Russia and their friends were China and Iran. Well, that plan seems out the window.
Well, let's look at some of the enemy within in the financial markets. Here's another story in the headlines. Meet the Snowball, the crazy debt deal uncovered by an ex-Goldman banker that almost sunk Portugal's railway. By the way, this ex-Goldman banker, he's a Syrian immigrant to the UK. His name is George Jabour, and he came to the UK from Damascus in 2004, earned a master's, and began working in finance. Anyway, he left Goldman Sachs in 2009 and set up his own company, Ethos, to advise governments on the very types of swap transactions that he helped put together. Now, this is a swap transaction that engaged Santander Bank in 2005. The deal started, but it actually came into effect in 2007. So during at the beginning of the financial crisis, so. It's a complicated debt deal where Portugal thought they were lowering their interest rate on some debt they used for the rail system. And it was an 80 million euro debt, and they were paying 4.79% interest. They're now paying 40% interest, And the debt has grown to from 89 million to 459 million in less than a decade, well under a decade. And yeah, so this is a story we see over and over and over. We saw this with Greece, the same thing. In fact, within 2 years of signing their deal with Goldman Sachs, their debt had like quadrupled because of all these like exploding swap interest rate swaps. They actually are not what they thought they signed. So this guy advises governments on how to get out of these deals. Right now, this deal is in court. Their debt has snowballed, and so has their interest rate. But these you should consider these hostile acts because the bankers themselves know what they're getting into. The person negotiating on behalf of the taxpayer, your government, they tend not to understand the malicious intent that these bankers go into this deal. That they know what they've hidden in the contract, and these naive treasury officials and finance officials from our governments have no idea. They see a smiling banker with a nice cut suit and nice handmade shoes, and they think they must be telling the truth.
Right. Well, it destroys the f economic immune system of a country. So it's the equivalent of financial aids that these bankers give these countries like Portugal. Now, the key phrase there, the key word there is almost, that they almost destroyed Portugal. Because the fact is that they did destroy Portugal, but that the ECB, the European Central Bank, acts as a lender of last resort. So any banker putting together an illegitimate, fraudulent swaps deal like this knows that they can pack the derivatives explosives to the max and blow the country up without any regard for any prudency or fiduciary responsibility because the central bank will bail out the country. So that's been the modus operandi going back to the savings and loan crisis in America, where the federal government guaranteed depositors. And the bankers took all the deposits and went to the horse races and bet all their money and lost it all. And the federal government had to bail them all out. Same thing with the recent 2008 crisis, where you remember the Hank Paulson went in front of Congress and said we need a $750 billion check to bail out all these banks that were playing the system, gaming the system, relying on this bailout, including his ex-employer Goldman Sachs. So no one has stepped in and said, we really need to stop these banking terrorists from packing derivative explosives and financial aids and just trying to destroy and ultimately destroying these countries, whether it's Greece or Portugal or eventually France will be come under similar. I mean, if they thought the Paris attacks from a couple of weeks ago were bad, wait till the bankers show up, then they'll know true horror. And it'll cause a lot more human suffering. But so far, no one's, doing anything to stop the plague of loafer-wearing banking terrorists.
Well, in the last 5 minutes, I do want to call your attention to we interviewed Tina Louise Rothery for today's episode of Kaiser Report. And so there's a big giant, there's supposed to be a major march all across the country for these environmental march. Of course, we were in the US for Thanksgiving over on the East Coast, where there's normally snow. It's quite often snow by Thanksgiving. And of course, instead, we were in t-shirts. And my stepfather was in shorts. It was very, very warm. We were on the beach. And, this is, of course, part of El Nino. But on top of that, the global warming accelerating. I see there's another hurricane, the latest ever major hurricane that they say it exploded overnight from again off of Mexico from nothing to Category 4. So November 27th. And the previous latest major hurricane was November 24th, quite a few decades ago. And it was a Category 3. So this is a Category 4, the biggest ever in the Western Hemisphere. this late in the season. And tomorrow there are big protests trying to tell people that our so-called leaders meeting in Paris for these COP thing. I forget what the COP stands for, climate organization policy, something like that. So of course they're not allowed to protest in Paris right now because there's a state of emergency and the government can declare whatever they want to declare and investigate whoever they want to investigate. So they're doing the protest elsewhere.
This hurricane popped up. The violence of the weather is equaling the geopolitical violence and the economic violence, and the shopping violence. So you have four waves of violence all coming together in this inferno of violence. It's kind of interesting. Talking about violence, the jihadis have put together what everyone is now recognizing as extraordinarily slick propaganda videos that are in every respect recreations of the advertisements you'll see for these very, very violent video games. And the young jihadists that are being recruited by these terrorist organizations are, video gamers. And so these propaganda videos put them in the video game and they take them through these scenes and they do the exact same violence. I find it interesting that in all the finger pointing that's gone on recently, who's responsible for this wave of terrorism? The very obvious connection to these video games is not being explored more fully, probably because of the Motion Picture Association of America, that is intimately involved in that industry and has one of the most powerful lobby groups in Washington, along with the arms dealers. So not only are the arms dealers going up, but Hollywood enjoys huge terror dividends by these jihadi attacks in Paris and elsewhere. Huge, huge.
Well, it's also the young of today. I guess, your brain is still developing up until you're about 1920, and then it all goes downhill again. So I think, a lot of, when we were kids, we didn't have these video games, so our mind was formed by nature and observing and reading and innovating and creating and making our own games out of sticks and mud and, various things we could find outside. Whereas today their minds are a little bit more passive and they're receiving all this stuff from a very young age. But that's for another show.
Well, the most violent game we had was a game called Time Bomb, which was a little black plastic ball with a fuse, and you wind it and you throw it back and forth. And if you're the one caught when it goes click, you're the loser. And that was the most, because my brother used to play this, and of course, he'd throw this at me, and try to hit me, and it became a violent game. But that was about it.
It was only violent because your brother threw it
Of
at you,
course, my
so.
older brother, anytime, the older brother has a chance to pick on the younger brother, of course, is exploited.
Okay, well, that's it for this episode of The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM. We'll see you next week.
All right, then. Bye, y'all.